Welcome back to Palisade Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics, and joining me today is Brent Johnson. He owns a wealth management firm in San Francisco called Santiago Capital. How are you today, Brent?
I'm good. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to talking to you.
Absolute honor to have you, sir. You're probably best known for the dollar milkshake theory, and that name came from a movie called There Will Be Blood. The whole thing stems from, as you see it, a supply-demand mismatch with regards to dollars in the world. So could you explain to us, give us a little rundown on the theory as you've laid it out for the last couple of years, please?
Yeah, sure. So going back to the movie that you referenced, there's a scene near the end of the movie where this very ruthless oil executive is trying to buy the land next to his because it has oil on it, and the guy just won't sell it to him. And the guy finally just gets so frustrated. He says, you know what? It doesn't really matter whether I own your land or not, because all I have to do is stick an oil well down into the ground and I can actually suck up the oil, even though it's on your side of the fence. And he references a milkshake. He says, even if you have a milkshake, but I have a long straw and I put my straw in your milkshake, I drink your milkshake. And, you know, when I saw that, I thought that was a very good analogy for what I see going on over the last couple of years and what I think is going to pick up speed and be even to a greater extent over the next couple of years. And that, you know, post global financial crisis of 2008 and 2009, the world central banks and monetary authorities got together and they printed all this different currency and made this, what I just kind of call this currency milkshake of dollars and yens and euros and pounds and reals, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, for a number of reasons, I feel like the U.S. has the straw. And for a few years there, we were actually raising interest rates, and that acted as a straw to suck up all the liquidity that the rest of the world was providing. And I think that's largely why you saw the U.S. markets do what they did. But it wasn't just based on interest rates. Interest rates was the primary driver, but not the only driver. And there's a number of other factors, such as, you know, we have the deepest financial markets in the world. There's a large amount of U.S. dollar denominated debt outside the United States, which acts as demand for the dollar. The U.S. Navy enforces the dollar as the global reserve currency. The rule of law, the tax policy, trade policy. There's a number of factors that lead to the U.S. being one of, if not the most hospitable place for foreign capital. And I think all of that acts as a straw which sucks up the global capital from around the world. And I expect that to actually accelerate over the next couple of years rather than decrease. So that's kind of the theory in a nutshell.
So recently you posted an update for the theory on Twitter in regards to what we've seen since the little bit of a crash that we had because of COVID. Maybe give us a couple points on what you got right and how you see some of the things that maybe you got wrong from the original thesis.
Sure. So the first thing I'll say with regard to the thesis, what I try to do is I always try to figure out a way to tell a story, for lack of a better word, in a way that, you know, kind of the common person can understand who's not perhaps, you know, enmeshed in global finance and doesn't know all the lingo and all the different little acronyms. And I've always worked with individuals as opposed to institutions. And so I've always had to explain to individuals kind of what I saw going on in the market. And so that's why I kind of try to use that type of a language. And in order for a story to make sense, you kind of have to tell it in linear fashion. But the reality is that global markets very rarely play out in linear fashion. You know, you can come up with 10 or 11 different chapters of a story, but, you know, when it actually plays out, chapter 3 might become before chapter 2 and chapter 8 might come before chapter 5. I see a number of different things playing out over the next couple of years, and I've tried to lay it out in a way that makes sense, but I am by no means of the opinion that I'm going to get everything absolutely right. And there's going to be some stuff that I get absolutely incorrect. But I think if I get even some of it right, I'm going to be ahead of most other people who don't have a similar theory. And so I guess what I would say, you know, with regard to this recent update, one of the things that the milkshake theory, subscribes to that has been kind of controversial, for lack of a better word, is the idea that U.S. equities are going to go to all-time highs and along with the dollar going higher. And there's a number of people who just don't agree with that. You know, I've had a lot of people reach out and say that's not going to happen. I've had other people say, you know, the dollar is going to go higher, but then equities can't. Or I've had other people say equities can go higher, but then the dollar's got to go lower. And so that has probably been the biggest source of either confusion or challenging of my thesis. And so the other part of it is that even though I think equities are going higher over the next couple of years, I was also of the opinion late last year and early this year that we were going to have a strong pullback before that happened. Now, we had that strong pullback in March, and I was kind of prepared for that and, you know, did pretty well through the March time period. And, you know, we got fairly aggressive at the bottom and, you know, come up out of the bottom in March into April. But what was happening is the market was rallying on dollar weakness. It wasn't rallying along with the dollar. It was basically rallying on a liquidity injection by the Federal Reserve and other monetary authorities and the extension of swap lines, which I'm sure we'll talk about at some point. And so the point I was trying to make on Twitter, you know, with a recent update was that this rally in equities, this is not the rally in equities that I see that's the heart of the milkshake. It doesn't mean that this can't happen for a little while. But the point I was trying to make is that when I see equities going back to their all-time highs and making new all-time highs, I think that is going to be as a result of a increasing currency crisis around the world in which people are going to flee their local economies and search out the United States as a safe haven. Now, that again, that's not what has been happening. Over the last 2 to 3 months, all global asset prices have been rallying, you know, not just U.S. asset prices. And so while I certainly understand why it's happening, this is not the heart of the milkshake theory. And I actually think that we will still have another pullback, short-term pullback in equities, probably between now and the end of the election or maybe Q1 of next year before we get into kind of the heart of the crisis, where other economies start to break down, and as a result, the United States start to get some flows from the chaos abroad. So while I understand what's going on right now, the point I wanted to make was I don't think we're in the throes of the milkshake theory yet. We're still kind of in the early innings, so to speak.
So that kind of leads me into part of what your update was, is you were saying that you could be wrong or early wrong. So maybe can we contrast those two situations of early wrong versus just wrong?
Sure. So I've been accused of being a little overconfident in my theory. And I guess I would say I've seen nothing to derail it yet. I am open to, first of all, I can absolutely be wrong. There is no guarantee that I'm right. Now, I obviously wouldn't be pounding the table on my thesis as much as I have if I didn't have a strong degree of confidence that I'm right. But you always have to be prepared to be wrong. And I am prepared to be wrong. I just haven't seen anything yet to tell me that I am. The main problem is that I see this supply-demand imbalance between the dollars that exist and the dollars that are needed. The common challenge to my thesis is that the Fed will provide however many dollars are needed to the rest of the world and to the United States economy. If they end up doing that, then I will be wrong. And I will be wrong on an absolute basis. However, I don't think that that's going to happen. But we'll have to just wait and see. But that's one way I could just be completely and absolutely wrong. The other way I could be wrong is I could just be early. And maybe the dollar sells off over the next 6 to 12 months because of a number of things that the Fed is able to do in the short term, but that they are not able to solve in the long term. And that we end up right back where we are, or we end up right back where we were in March, you know, next March or next July or something like that. And in that case, I will have been early and the thesis won't have played out yet, but I still have the opportunity to be right in the future. So I could be wrong in the short term, but still be right in the long term. It's very similar to people who have owned gold for the last 7 or 8 years. You know, in 2011 and 2012, many people in the gold world said, you know, $2,000, $3,000, $5,000, here we come. Well, you know, it's 8 years later and we're still below $2,000. Now, I happen to believe that that is still going to play out. I still happen to believe that gold's going to go to $5,000 and probably even higher than that. But it doesn't change the fact that many people, myself included, in the gold world were wrong. Now, in that case, we were early wrong. and perhaps dramatically early wrong. But that's another way that you can be wrong in the short term, but still have it pay off in the long term. And the point I like to make with regard to everything that the central banks and the Fed in particular has done, whether you want to talk about just the last 3 months or the last 10 years, nothing has been fundamentally solved. There's been no new programs or new structure to the monetary system which will keep the problems that have happened over the last 10 years from happening again. Everything that has been done has been to build upon what has already been done. In other words, it ultimately makes the problem bigger. It does not solve it. They paper over it. They extend loans. They provide new loans. They print more money. But it doesn't actually fix anything. And so that's why I say it's possible that I'm still early, but that I still don't think I would be wrong in the long term, because I've seen nothing that fixes the long-term problem. And essentially, the long-term problem is the design of the monetary system itself. Because all money is loaned into existence, and because we have a fractional reserve banking system, without going into too much detail as to why, I just have to say that for that kind of a system to continue, you either need to have a high level of velocity of money where trade is happening, where people are spending, where the economy is moving, or you need to have extension of new credit. You have to have one or the other. But the design of the monetary system does not have a reverse gear. So if the monetary system or the global economy, for lack of a better word, starts to reverse, or it starts to contract, or it starts to slow down, or it starts to go backwards, however you want to describe that, it actually breaks the system. The system collapses on itself. And that is why when you get into credit contractions or banking crises or recessions or depressions or however you want to define that negative global economic growth, that is why you see the Fed and the other central banks come in and recollateralize the system. It's very similar to a margin account. If you buy stocks on margin and the stocks go up in price, there's no problem. But if those stocks start to fall, then you get a margin call and you have to put new cash into the account to bring it back up to where it's collateralized appropriately. It's the exact same concept with the global monetary system. As long as everything's going up, there's no problem. But the minute that those asset prices start to fall, the Fed and the other central banks need to come in and add new cash to the margin account. The issue right now is that there are two different dollar markets. Most people don't realize this, but there's a United States domestic US dollar market, and then there is an offshore dollar market called euro dollars. Now, to be clear, euro dollars are different than euros, so don't confuse those two. Euro dollars are basically dollars that exist outside the United States in banking accounts and other financial institutions, and basically any extension of dollar-based credit outside the United States by non-US banking firms. The issue is that as long as everything is growing and asset prices are rising, there's not a problem. But when we get into this case where asset prices start to fall and those stock prices start to fall and that, the margin account needs new collateral added to it, there is no entity or institution outside of the United States that has the authority or the ability to inject new dollars into the system. And that's what it needs. It doesn't need new euros. It doesn't need new yen. It doesn't need yuan or reals. It needs dollars. But only the Fed can inject dollars. But the Fed doesn't have jurisdiction or authority to inject dollars into Brazil or into Europe or into China. And so that is why the problem now is that the global dollar debt issued by entities outside the United States at a minimum is $13 trillion. And there's some measurements. And if you start looking into like shadow banking and some of these, dark pools of credit that are available, you can actually get to the argument to where it's actually double that size. But even if we just use the $13 trillion number, that's a huge amount of capital and demand for dollars outside the United States. And when the economy slows down and goes backwards, not only is it tough for those entities to service the $13 trillion of debt, but it makes it almost impossible for them to pay off those loans when they come due. And so the argument has been made that the Fed will just bail out the rest of the world, and they will print however many dollars are needed to give to the rest of the world via swap lines with other central banks. And that's kind of the heart of the problem. I don't think that they will be able to bail out the rest of the world with swap lines. Many people who disagree with my theory think that they will. They think that the Fed will provide however many dollars the U.S. and the global economy needs, and that they will just paper this over, and that the dollar will lose an incredible amount of value versus other currencies. I think that's wrong for a number of reasons, but that's kind of the heart of the issue right there.
Absolutely, Brent. There's so many places to go from there. The first thing I think of, if you're early wrong, is there some kind of a concession with your bet with Peter Schiff about maybe moving that goalpost down a little bit?
Well, you know, I will say I'm more than happy to keep betting Peter Schiff gold coins on whether the dollar rises or the dollar falls. You know, I think it's kind of fun and it's kind of interesting and it kind of livens it up a little bit. I've said many times that I think Peter has probably the best understanding and is best able to explain better than anybody else in the world of where we're going to end up and why we're going to end up there. I just don't think he has a good understanding of the road that we're traveling to get there. So, you know, whether the dollar goes higher this year or the dollar goes higher next year, until something fundamentally changes with the design of the system, I'm happy to make that bet every year.
Absolutely. When I was reading through your update, Brent, one of the questions I came up with was, what do you mean by the Fed has created new dollars, but not more dollars?
Okay, so this kind of goes back to the design of the monetary system and the way capital gets created and the way capital gets destroyed. When you deposit money into a bank, the bank doesn't keep all that money in the bank. They keep 10% of it in the bank, and then so you put $100 in, they keep 10 and loan out 90. The next guy that gets 90, he's got $90 in his account, they keep, you know, $9 of that and then loan out another 81. And they keep doing this and keep doing this until $1,000 becomes $10,000 of new money.
And that's the fractional reserve, right?
That's fractional reserve banking, yes. And so that is fine. Again, as long as asset prices are rising and new credit is being extended, it's no problem. The problem becomes when a couple people can't repay their loans and the bank doesn't get that money back. And then the people who have accounts go in to withdraw their money and there's not enough money to go around. And the point is when money gets loaned into existence, it gets created out of thin air. But when loans start to default and they default at a high enough rate that the whole system becomes impaired, money disappears. The money supply crashes. And that's why if you get that's basically the definition of a credit crunch, right? When loans are no longer being extended, you can't get access to new financing, and then you default, and then whoever you defaulted on, they don't receive their money, and so then they can't pay the people that they borrowed from. You get into this reverse spiral. And so my point of the Fed is creating new dollars but not more dollars is they're trying to fill up a bucket that has holes in it. So if you have a 5-gallon bucket and it's got a bunch of holes in it, and a gallon is leaking out per minute, and you're adding a gallon per minute, you're not putting more water into the bucket. You're just trying to keep the bucket full. And it's kind of the same thing with the monetary system. You know, with the COVID crisis and with the slowdown in the global economy and with dollar loans not getting paid and with the credit crunch, you know, defaults are happening. Money is not being created. It's being destroyed. And what the Fed is trying to do, the Fed is trying to plug that hole. They're trying to recollateralize the system. And so, yeah, they're putting new water into the bucket, but they're not putting water into a bucket that doesn't have holes in it. They're putting water into a bucket that's leaking. Now, if there was no leaking of the bucket and the bucket was in perfectly good shape and they just out of the blue decided to pour money into the bucket, well, then, yeah, you're creating more money. But right now, they're just trying to replace the money that's being destroyed to recollateralize the system. And I think that's an important thing to understand is, you know, the Fed, when the Fed is not a proactive agency, and this goes for all central banks. They're all reactive agencies. So if there was no demand for the dollar and the dollar was falling, there would be no reason for the Fed to print more of it. The reason that the Fed is printing dollars is because there's a huge demand for it. In other words, if nobody wanted the dollar, it'd be very easy to get them because people just give them away to you. But it's actually the opposite. What happened in March was a huge spike in demand for dollars, so much so that everything that's priced in dollars got sold in order to get the dollars themselves. The Fed was responding to huge demand for dollars, both from the U.S. and from the external community. That is why the Fed extended swap lines to all these other countries, was to get these other countries access to dollars that they didn't have the ability to print themselves.
So can we see these swap lines kind of used as a weapon by extending them to some countries and not others?
Absolutely. And that's a big part of my thesis and why I think, that's why I think this problem is going to continue, because I think, first of all, I need to explain how a swap lines works. And I know we're kind of getting down into the nitty gritty details of central banking and most people's eyes are going to glaze over. But just to understand, when we extend swap lines to other countries, we are not just giving them dollars. These are not gifts. These are loans. So we are loaning, as an example, we will swap, let's just use $1 billion. We will give the European Central Bank $1 billion and they will give us $1 billion of euros, or $1 billion worth of dollars in euros. And it's a swap. And at some point down the road, those need to be swapped back. The reason that we give them dollars is because corporations, banks, individuals in those other countries have dollar financing needs. Either they took out a dollar loan or they conduct trade in dollars, or for whatever reason, it's part of all this dollar denominated debt or dollar needs, euro dollar market outside the United States. But, you know, these swap lines have maturity dates, and at some point they need to swap those dollars back. Now, the idea is that they can just keep extending these forever. And that is true. They can do that. But what you got to remember is when we give dollars to the ECB, the ECB's got to pledge euros for those. Now, where does the ECB – so people will say if we're printing the dollars to do that, that's going to be bad for the U.S. dollar because we have to print all these dollars to give to the rest of the world. Well, that would be true, again, if these were gifts and we were just the only ones handing out the currency. But what you have to remember is that the ECB has to give us their currency. And Europe is in bad shape as well. And Japan is in bad shape as well. And Brazil is in bad shape as well. So if we're giving them $1 billion worth of currency and they're giving us $1 billion of their currency, where are they getting the $1 billion of their currency to give to us? Well, they have to print it too. So it's not like we are printing and they are not. You know, if the ECB had all this currency just sitting around, they could just use that to help out their companies. But they don't. They need dollars. And so they've got to print at the same rate we are to get the swaps. And when we swap our dollars to the ECB then goes to their banks in their jurisdiction and hands out those dollars. And then those banks that got those dollars, they hand out those dollars in the form of new loans to the corporations. That money that's going to these corporations, it's extending new loans. It's not paying off old loans. So all it is doing is increasing or making bigger the problem of the dollar debt. It's actually reinforcing the demand for dollars. It's not negating the demand for dollars. And so that's why I say, yeah, they can extend these problems, or they can extend these issues and it can push it off down the road and I can be early wrong. But until they actually deal with paying off all this dollar debt in the world, the problem still exists. And if you pay off an old loan with a new loan, you are not solving the problem. You are just extending it. And so that's kind of, and so to your point, can these be used as a weapon? They absolutely can be used as a weapon. In the same way that the U.S. has cut off, you know, access to the SWIFT system to countries like Russia and Iran and some of these other countries in times of, discord or, for lack of a better, geopolitical turmoil, they can do the same thing with swap lines. You know, they're not going to give a swap line to somebody to bail out their economy if we're also putting sanctions on them for some geopolitical reason that we don't agree with. And so I think we're going to get into this, you know, G2 world where, you know, it's going to be China and their minions and the United States and their minions. And, you know, if you want dollar financing, which everybody needs to operate on the global stage, then, you know, you're going to kind of have to play ball. Now, I should also point out that I don't necessarily like it that this is the way it is. I don't necessarily like the U.S. foreign policy and the way that we kind of demand tribute, so to speak, and to do our bidding in order to get access to either protection of our military or our dollar funding or whatever it is. But it doesn't really matter if I like it or not. What matters is the way it is. So this is the way it is. Whether you like it or not, the United States is the global superpower. The United States military is the biggest military in the world. The United States is the biggest consumer market in the world. Now, whether we deserve all this or whether we don't, that's an entirely different topic for discussion. But the fact of the matter is that is who we are, and that is the power that we have. And so I think it's important to keep that in mind as you're allocating capital.
Absolutely. And as we see this from a realistic point of view, why don't you give us kind of a way to look at this on how to actually play with the currency from if you're denominated in non-US dollars. So let's take, for example, Canadian dollars.
Yeah.
You were recently saying that we could see the Canadian dollar go down or up, however you want to say it, to $2 US.
Yeah.
Is there a way to actually protect ourselves if we're not denominated in dollars?
Yeah. So, well, the first way you can do it is again, if I think that gold's going to do very well over the next 4 or 5 years, maybe not over the next 4 or 5 months, but over the next 4 or 5 years, I think gold's going to do very well in all currencies, even the dollar. Now, if the dollar is going to go up, you know, 50% versus the Canadian dollar, well, then if you own gold, you're not just making money in US dollar terms, but you're making a lot more in Canadian dollar terms. People who are denominated in Canadian dollars and who have gold and the miners, I have no problem with that at all. I think that's actually very wise to have an allocation of your portfolio to those types of positions. Now, if you have cash sitting on the sidelines and you have the ability to, which I imagine there's a number of banking institutions or financial institutions in Canada that allow you to hold your cash in dollars, so that's what I would do. I would hold my cash in dollars rather than Canadian dollars. Because if your cash is in US dollars and the Canadian dollar goes down 10%, well, you just made 10% on your money or on your purchasing power. So I would definitely keep cash in US dollars rather than Canadian dollars. The other thing that I think will happen is that, you know, as we get further into this crisis, and as I think US dollar equities go up in global terms, but they go up in US dollar terms, but they especially go up in other currencies. So as an example, if you're a Canadian and you have some capital that you want to, you know, do better than just sitting in cash and making the rise against the dollar, the Canadian dollar, let's say you buy Coca-Cola, right? And let's say the Canadian dollar goes down 10%. And let's say Coca-Cola pays a 3% dividend. Well, you just made 13%. And that's if Coca-Cola just stays flat for the year. Now, if Coca-Cola goes up 6 or 7%, all of a sudden, as a Canadian, you just made 20%. So, you know, that's not too bad of a return, right? And I think it's going to be much easier just to do that in foreign currency terms than in U.S. dollar terms. And so if I was a, you know, asset manager or an asset allocator in an emerging market or one of these international markets where I think the currency is going to go down, I would be looking very closely at large cap U.S. equities that pay dividends. I think that's going to be a good place to kind of ride out the storm over the next couple of years.
Interesting. And another kind of piece to that, let's say dollar versus dollar or currency versus currency, that we need to consider is that most of the world's junior speculators are denominated in Canadian dollars or Australian dollars, right?
Right. That's right. So, yeah. And so, you know, that's the thing. If you have a company that's mining gold and selling that product in dollars, but they're paying for their costs in Canadian dollars or Australian dollars, you know, that's a pretty good arbitrage. Now, where you have to be a little bit careful is, you know, if you countries are going to need dollars as well. And, at the end of the day, countries don't have their own money. They get money from taxing their citizens and their corporations. And so if the countries need dollars, the first place they're going to look is they're corporations that do business in dollars. And they're going to put taxes or levies or, you know, they're going to squeeze those dollar industries for dollars. And you've already started to see this in places like Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, Zimbabwe. I think this is going to continue to happen, you know, and I think you got to be very careful, especially if you own a company that has a gold mine in a country that doesn't have a swap line. You know, I think that's an additional risk you have to factor in. Now, does that mean that you shouldn't invest in that company? Not necessarily. It's just a risk factor that you should be aware of. So, again, I think it's very important to understand the dollar dynamics versus local currencies, you know, over the next, call it 2 to 3 to 4 years.
Absolutely. That you just touched on one of my next questions was to consider that risk of big gold producers in non-swap line countries. So specifically speaking about gold, Brent, you were saying we could back up the truck on gold, especially, you know, if we talk about from a different currency than the US. Where do you see gold kind of fitting in and what do you see gold doing in the next, let's say, 6 to 12 months?
Yeah. So first of all, I'll say that absolutely everybody should own gold. It should be the bedrock of everybody's portfolio. I've said this for years. I continue to believe this. You know, in 2016, when gold was starting to break out, I said that I didn't think gold was going to break out yet because I thought the dollar was going to make its move first. And I got a lot of criticism for that. Gold was around 1400 at that point. But you know what? Gold didn't break out. Gold went back down. And until almost a year ago, exactly from now, gold was at $1,200 or $1,300. So, you know, from 2016 to middle of 2019, gold didn't do anything. It went down, it went up, it went sideways, but it didn't really make any money. Now, last year, it broke out pretty hard. And I was not prepared for that to happen. But I still own gold, but I told people that I didn't think the breakout was going to happen yet. But you know what? It did. So I kind of got that wrong. But, you know, and then people said, well, at what level, you know, that was kind of the 1400 level was the breakout level. And people said, oh, you missed it. You're never going to get another chance. Well, you know what? In March, you know where gold went to? Gold went to 1445. You know, it was up at 1600, 1700. And when we had that dollar spike and everybody had to liquidate, people didn't rush into gold. People sold their gold. Now, you know, and gold pulled back, you know, a couple hundred bucks. And so did I miss you know, that $45 from 1400 to 1445 or 50. Yeah, of course I did. But, you know, like I said, I still own gold. My point is not that you shouldn't own gold. My point is that when it comes down to it, people need to have dollars. They don't need to have gold. They may want to have gold, and I may want to have gold, but to operate on the world stage, you need dollars. And when they had to choose between dollars and gold in March, they chose dollars. Now, after we got through that liquidity squeeze, gold came back faster than anything else, and the miners came back faster than anything else. But when liquidity needs come, you know, dollars are favored. And I'm not convinced that the next time that we need dollars, which I'm sure is coming, that the same thing won't happen again. Now, maybe it won't. Maybe people are going to continue to buy gold and silver, and especially in foreign currencies, you know, not US dollar terms. If I was a Canadian dollar investor or an Australian dollar investor or a yen investor, I would have no qualms about gold right now. And again, if you have a long-term time horizon and you don't mind what gold does on a monthly basis or a weekly basis, then there's no reason not to own gold now. I'm just saying that it might not, just because you should own gold now, doesn't mean it's going to $2,000 right now. It wouldn't surprise me at all for us to go back to the $1,400, $1,500 range again. I think the odds of it going to $1,000 or something like that are pretty low at this point. And if it did, it would be an incredible buying opportunity. But I'm also not convinced we're going to be at $2,500 in a year either.
Absolutely. So from your point of view, Brent, are you looking actually at the miners and any juniors, or are you kind of looking more at the physical or ETF side?
Yeah, I don't own any of the miners or the juniors at this point. I own bullion. I suggest people own bullion. Again, if you're not dollar denominated, then yeah, I think you could own some select miners. I would focus on the big producers. I'm not looking for the junior space right now. I know a lot of people are, but it's just not my game.
Excellent. Could you give us some other examples of some asymmetric bets? I know that you, a couple of months ago, you were talking about call options on Canadian banker acceptance notes. Is there anything else like that that maybe nobody's really considering?
Yeah, so that was a great trade for us. In the fall, we bought a number of these Canadian bankers acceptance notes, call options on Canadian bankers acceptance notes. We did that because at the time the Bank of Canada was talking very hawkish, saying they weren't going to have to cut interest rates. We kind of thought that was ridiculous. So we said that, the best way to play it, the most asymmetric way we could find to play that was to buy these call options on these short-term Canadian bonds. And so, it went against us initially. We bought more of it. And then in February and March, when the Bank of Canada cut interest rates like four times in 4 weeks, those short-term bonds kind of went up a lot and our call options went through the roof. So we made a very, very nice profit on that trade. And we're continuing to look for other things like that. That was a rather unique one because it's a relatively small market. Not many people follow it, and even fewer people trade those notes. But those are the types of things we're looking for because sometimes those lesser followed markets provide the greatest return. Now, the biggest asymmetric trade we have on right now is we think that the Hong Kong peg is going to break, and we think that when that happens, the Hong Kong dollar will depreciate in the neighborhood of 20 to 30%, potentially more than that. But this is a peg that has existed for 30 years. And, there's a number, actually most people in the marketplace do not believe that this peg is going to break, basically due to the longstanding history of it and the amount of dollar reserves that the Hong Kong Monetary Authority has to defend it. We think that's wrong, but the fact that the majority of the people in the world think that we're wrong allows us to play this way in a very asymmetric opportunity. So you can buy, now it's not easy for an individual to do this, but on an institutional level, you can buy put options on the Hong Kong currency and you can get anywhere from 100 to 200 times leverage on the trade. So if you put up $1 million and you get 100 times leverage, that's $100 million of exposure to the Hong Kong currency. If it breaks and it moves 30%, that's a $30 million profit off of your $1 million investment. So those are the types of opportunities that exist if the dollar does what we think it's going to do. Now, if we're wrong, then it won't do it. And, that portion of our portfolio that's been allocated to these asymmetric opportunities won't pay off. But the nice thing about these asymmetric opportunities is that you can risk a little bit to make a lot. So you don't have to put a huge percent of your portfolio out there. You can put 5 or 10% of your portfolio out there as either a hedge or speculation, however you want to describe it. And, if that pays off, your 5 or 10% can become 20, 30, 40% of your portfolio. Now, is that guaranteed? Of course it's not. Is there risk involved? Of course there's risk involved. That's what a speculation is. But we think that a number of these speculative bets are favorable and that the asymmetry involved kind of, not mandates, but even if you're wrong, the odds are such that if you're right, it kind of necessitates taking a small percent of your portfolio and put it in these trades.
Very interesting, Brent. As we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to mention?
No, I just think that the next couple of years are going to be extremely volatile. I think they're going to be extremely confusing, and I think they're going to be extremely emotional. I think it's very important for you to have a roadmap of how you think things are going to go. And even though you have a roadmap, I think it's very important to be flexible and to be willing to kind of change lanes, take an exit here that maybe you didn't expect to take. And maybe you have to travel a different road than you initially thought. People ask me all the time or say that I'm stubborn and I'm not willing to change my mind. I'm absolutely willing to change my mind. I just haven't seen the need to do it yet. But there may be a time when I have to. I would challenge, I guess, those who say that I'm stubborn and have not changed my mind. I would ask those who are saying that to look at themselves and ask whether they've changed their mind in the last several years. I know a lot of people who sold out of equities and after the global financial crisis and never bought back in, that despite the market going up for 10 years and, going up 25 or going up 4 or 5x. And so I would say, maybe you need to relook at your ideas and your themes as well because I think what's going to happen over the next couple of years is I think things are going to happen that nobody thinks is possible. I'm sure I'm not going to get it all right. I'm sure things are going to happen that I don't think possible. And so I'm sure there's things that are going to happen that other people don't think is possible as well. So I think it's good to have a roadmap. It's good to have a core thesis, but I think it's also important to try to keep your wits, try to keep your emotions, and be prepared to change lanes when you need to.
Absolutely. Brent, before I let you go, I just had one quick question about why are you not really looking at the juniors, gold juniors right now, and more at the big producers?
Well, it kind of just goes back to my overall thesis. Like for my speculative capital, I would rather do these asymmetric dollar plays than do the junior miners. If other people have, they think they have a, you know, the other thing about junior miners is gold could go through the roof and these junior miners might never find an ounce of gold and they can still go down. So that's one of the reasons. The other thing is that, again, I'm still not convinced that a dollar spike isn't going to cause another liquidation in gold miners. I mean, gold miners went down 40 or 50% in March alone, right? Now they've recovered and maybe they'll continue going higher. But I think the dollar is going much higher. I don't think the dollar is going back to 100. I think the dollar is going to 120 and then 130 and then 150. Now, I have a hard time seeing how a small mining company is going to profit in that environment. You know, some of the bigger majors who have production, who have the staying power, I think will do fine in that. But I think some of these junior miners who maybe don't have the same liquidity profile would struggle in that environment.
Very interesting. Brent, we can find you at Santiago AU Fund on Twitter and santiagocapital.com, correct?
That's right. Happy to, if anybody wants to send me a question or an email, happy to answer. I will tell you, I get tons of emails and tons of direct messages and I try to answer them all, but you know, I don't always get to them. So I will do my best to answer, but if I miss one here or there, please forgive me.
Absolutely. Brent, thanks very much for your time today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.
Think you understand the junior mining sector and you think that the participants in the mining sector, junior mining sector, are good people and kind people, hit the bid.
How violent that term could be, it actually could be quite violent. It could be a rip your face off uranium rally.
And the world is always going to need raw material. It's going to need copper and gold and nickel and so forth.
Totally destabilized. Hey, troll, did you hear what's going on in Yemen?